I'm doing a podcast, Dizzy.
Welcome to the Too Cool for School podcast. I'm your host, Yannick, and on today's episode, we are talking about anti-racist practice in school and decolonizing the curriculum. And I've got two amazing guests with me today, and I'll allow them to introduce themselves.
Who's going first? Shall I jump in? I want Lavinia to go first. No, it's all right. I'm already talking. Hi. I'm Jeffrey Boachie. I'm an author. I'm a secondary school teacher of 16 years, but now I lecture at Manchester University, where I teach new teachers in the PTC course. I visit schools on a consultancy basis, focusing mainly on anti-racism, identity, masculinity, and curriculum issues. I do a bit of radio broadcasting and do some journalism from time to time, and I'm a dad. And it's an absolute pleasure to be here as well. I want to say that on record. So thank you for the invitation, and I'm really looking forward to having this chat.
I'm Lucinia. I'm the founder and CEO of the Black Curriculum, which is the Indian educational enterprise for Black history teaching in schools. And I'm also the founder of the Racial Impact Collective, which basically looks at justice in the grant-making world for new entrepreneurs. I'm also a writer, and I am interested a lot in reparations. It's something that is really piquing my interest, or has piqued my interest for the last 7 years. And it's something I want to see happen. So I'm really excited to be here as well.
So to start off with, I wanted to ask you guys, so as advocates of, you know, anti-racist practice, what barriers do you believe are most common that schools face when trying to implement anti-racist practice in schools?
Yeah, I mean, I think about this a lot because I spend a lot of time talking to teachers, educators, school governors about these issues. And it's amazing to think that things don't seem to move at the pace or rate that you expect them to when something is clearly urgent, right? So I'm thinking in my own head, what is stopping the urgency, the sense of we need to get this sorted out? What's getting in the way of that? And I think that at first, I used to think it was just apathy, that people were just apathetic. They just didn't care enough about racism to tackle it as a problem. But I think it's a bit deeper than that. I think that people are often unwilling to recognize racism because it means their discomfort is going to be provoked. And that means their whole world is going to be destabilized. And I think that's a bit different to apathy. It's actually being comfortable with the status quo. I know it sounds a bit harsh for the first question, but some people actually benefit from a white supremacist, post-colonial, racist paradigm that we live in. And then following on from that, I think that people are very bad at recognizing racism within themselves, what's been internalized, and within the systems they operate in. And when you add those two things up, people being bad at recognizing racism because they've not been taught about the history of it, and being unwilling to become uncomfortable, it leads to racism being dismissed. And I think that's one of the big barriers that I find as to why we're not just getting this thing sorted as a society. I don't know how you feel about that, Lavinia.
I generally agree. I think if you're really willing to solve something, it's like there's a quote I really love, my friend said it the other day. It's like, where your heart is, your action will follow. And it's like sometimes we just make excuses because we're just not interested. And I think ultimately it does boil down to that, like the benefit of changing the structures and the way that we think doesn't always align with those who have power. So I would agree. I'd also say that like the schooling system is super, super Victorian.
Yeah.
It's super clunky, it's super slow, and just when I'm thinking about like even examinations, assessments, like everything is very much process driven, and it has to be measured. And I think sometimes with work, it doesn't like it, like it can align, but it just doesn't work when you have to work within the structures, and the structure itself needs to be overhauled.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. Like, as someone that lived in education for a while, it was paying my mortgage for 16 years, you can see that anti-racism is not a key performance indicator of a successful school at all. There's nothing coming from the government to say this is a priority. There's nothing that says your school is better if it deals with these issues of racism, of identity-based discrimination well. So what it means is that if the school is only being measured on its on the currency of exam results, that's all it really worries about. If you take something like safeguarding, which in like, I don't know how old people listening are, I'm not this old, but in the 1970s, like safeguarding wasn't good in UK schools. Like it wasn't a key performance indicator. So therefore, safeguarding was an issue. Since that's been addressed, every teacher in the country has to be pretty good at safeguarding. That's just like the law. So schools are quite good at safeguarding. Take that into anti-racism and you kind of feel like, yeah, a similar thing could happen, but it is just not prioritized for various reasons that I'm sure we're going to get into.
Yeah. No, thank you. Thank you for that. That's very insightful. And you know, Jeff, you're right. Racism is uncomfortable. And it's about people acknowledging that actually to make a difference and to be intentional with the changes that we want to make, we need to get into, you know, a situation or an environment that is going to be, you know, uncomfortable. And I'm thinking, you know, a lot about what you've both said, and something that's really coming to mind is that question of who then implements these changes? Like, who are the experts? Who are the people that we need to get into schools to implement and really drive, you know, these policies and these changes around anti-racist practice?
I can start because I think initially when we started our work back in 2019, there were a few, like literally a few teachers who were like, this is just not our core. And I really resonated with that because I just felt that, you know, at the time, we just needed to get the information in. We just needed to work with as much teachers as we could. And then in conversation with some of the teachers, they were like, this is way bigger than us. Like, we could try our best. But like, ultimately, we have to report to SLT and then we have to report to the teacher. And those head teachers have to report to, like, especially if you're in an academy, like, that board, right? So, like, in doing this work, I've seen that it's, like, it's bigger than just the teachers. And as much as, like, some teachers have goodwill or they're personally motivated to get this to happen in schools, anti-racism to be a culture, we have to look behind the scenes, like, the people who are writing the specifications, the people who are controlling budgets, the people who are, like, dictating, like, what the priorities of the school is and or are. So I just think that there's, like, multiple fronts that you can work on depending on the objective. But ultimately, I think where people are not visible is where the power is.
I hear what you're saying, definitely, because one of the things that I've realised is that ignorance of like white supremacy as an ideology, of colonialism, of imperialism, of the capitalist patriarchy, all these things that add up to where we are now, ignorance of those things is inbuilt into the education system. So we're not supposed to challenge these things. And actually, most people haven't got a great working knowledge of any of that stuff. Most people don't know what racism really is. They think it's interpersonal racism. Like when someone calls you a racist name or is physically violent to you, that's interpersonal racism. But racism is like structures. It's institutional. It's ideological. It's scientific. It's linked to colonialism and capitalism in very, very profound ways. Now, without that knowledge, it means that the people with the power to do things don't have the knowledge to know what they're even doing. So who do you need when there's a problem? You need the person that understands the problem. Now, that is not all black people. That is not all marginalized people, because, like, it's not my job to fix racism. I'm just like, I was just born in 1982. It's my job to be a good human being and to, like, you know, and to watch Turtles when I was 8 years old and to hopefully contribute to society. But this idea that it's, you know, black people's job to fix anti-black racism is completely unfair, because ultimately, what we are, and I'm talking about people like us now, like we're in this chat now for a reason, and we found each other for a reason. We've gone out of our way to become knowledgeable and to do work that is of value to the world. Like, Lavinia, your work is of incredible value to the education system and to our society. Yeah. And there are people with a lot more power than you or I that do not recognize that. So who needs to lead the charge on this? I feel like the people with the power need to throw their hands up and say, I don't understand this. Like when you've got a problem with your plumbing, you call a plumber because that person knows plumbing and you trust them. And if they say you've got to break that wall to get to the pipe, you don't go, get out of my house. You say, all right, cool. We need to do that. Otherwise, I've got a problem with my pipes. Sorry, I'm stretching the metaphor, but you know what I'm saying? So if they could just listen to people who are knowledgeable, who are in this, who have gone out of their way, then we could start to make that change happen. But do people want to be told they've got leaky pipes? I don't know. I don't know. Do people want that information?
Yeah, no, that's very telling. Thank you for sharing. And you made a point earlier, Jeff, when you was talking about, you know, safeguarding practices in the 70s and how it wasn't good. And now, you know, schools have been very intentional with, you know, implementing those policies and training teachers, etc. I've only worked in education for about 7-8 years now, so not as you know, seasoned and knowledgeable as you both.
Oh, it's long enough.
But I wanted to know, when did anti-racist practice become a thing? When was that shift? Like, did something happen in schools? Did something happen in like the UK or the community that, you know, schools started to say, actually, you know, we need this? Like, when did it become a thing? Because when I first started working in education in 2017, I don't recall it at the time being a thing or even discussed. So when did that shift happen?
The real answer is that there have been grassroots, community-driven programs and initiatives in this area for a long time. Wow. This is a thing which is often disregarded because the mainstream doesn't like to highlight things that are problematic to the mainstream. This is not new work. There are people that have been doing this for generations. You know, there were supplementary schools going back to, you know, post-war in this country that actually gave birth to whole thoughts and individuals who are in this space that did work that made changes happen, but that work was not supported. Those books that were written were not recommissioned. These curriculum, they weren't developed. They weren't taught to successive generations. So I'm like you, it wasn't in my head because it wasn't taught to me. But since I've done more of this work, I've realized there's a long legacy of it. Actually, it's just a hidden legacy. I don't know what your thoughts are, Lavinia, in terms of when did it come to you in terms of like your own journey? When did you realize, no, hang on, this is a thing that I can get involved in?
Yeah.
That's a hard question, maybe.
No, that's a really good breakdown, because I was thinking, and of course, like Saturday school, I think, has been the thrust of this work to continue throughout my education. Or like alternative, I hate that word, alternative schooling. Alternative schooling. But I really feel that 2016 probably was a year that I remember. A lot of the discourse kind of coming from South Africa and coming into the UK from Rosemary Fall, and then like, why is my curriculum so white? I remember those being discussions where I was like, oh, okay, yeah, this is kind of true. Like, our curriculums are really, really bad. And not only are they mad, but they need to be questioned and challenged and like criticized, right? So I think for me, the conversation probably clicked in 2016 from like a university level and then kind of started to filter down. That's just my observation. And then of course, when the pendulum swings, i.e. racism on a large scale is thoroughly done. So I'm thinking about Windrush, which was the year after the Windrush scandal, the Home Office scandal. Then I'm thinking 2 years after that, the murder of George Floyd. Like those moments where the pendulum swings and everybody starts talking is when there's like a reaction. And I think I saw reactions 2017, 2020, and probably again. You know what I mean?
So, yeah.
Those are kind of three things that I can think about.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for sharing. And, you know, on this sort of talk about, you know, policies, you know, school often have, you know, diversity policies, you know, inclusion policies, etc. What differentiates an anti-racist policy as opposed to a school just having, you know, an inclusive policy? Because sometimes, you know, schools will do that. Oh, well, we're inclusive. So because we're inclusive, it must mean we're anti-racist. But, you know, it's not the same thing. So how do you differentiate, you know, the two, and what really stands out as, you know, anti-racist policy as opposed to a policy that's just inclusive?
Yeah, a lot of school leaders would like to have the answer to that served up to them on a platter, because a lot of the time, a lot of these policies are, they can be very tokenistic, which is just whereby they just say very vague things that sound about right from a liberal perspective. You see that a lot, you know, like we, you know, seek to, and it's like not discriminate, and everyone does, and it's all very tokenistic because it doesn't do anything particularly rigorous in terms of addressing the deep-seated cultural issues that feed into racism, looking at the 360 picture of the curriculum, the what's happening politically, the histories, both local and even global. So I think part of it is the level of rigor. These policies can't just be reactive either. I think the best policies are going to be responsive and proactive. They're going to be looking sort of out of their way and preempting things and understanding that we're in a context that is dangerous for certain communities, rather than waiting for a racist thing to happen and then reacting to that. That's not a policy. A policy needs to preempt. It needs to be honest enough to know there's an issue in the first place. So I think that those are two of the distinctions. I'm going to stop there, though, because I can see the cogs turning, Lavinia. I can see the cogs turning in your mind.
As you talk, I'm like, yes, yes, yes. So I would add that there needs to be, like, investment. I just always think of, like, policies as a live document, right? Like, it's more than just somebody writing it, and then it's buried in, like, this book, and then you just bring it out when something happens. It needs investment. It needs review. And, like, when I say investment, I mean that, like, somebody is actively, or a group of people are actively monitoring it. It's actually embedded within, like, the hiring of a person. It's embedded within, you know, the review, their reviews. It's embedded within, like, you know, like, weekly meetings, so that we can actually, like, take and practice steps towards it. So I think it needs time investment. I think it needs financial investment. I think it needs to have, like, monitoring from people who are outside, because often there's no accountability for schools. And I think the issue is that, like, a racist incident can happen and it's just buried, and, like, nobody speaks about it again until, for example, in the case of Child Q, somebody finds out about it and, like, starts talking about it. But, like, who is holding these schools and these teachers responsible? So I think that is the key, that, like, this document is, I think document, but, like, this idea of a policy is an active thing. It's not just, like, passive.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, as well, you know, encouraging schools to think about the policies that they have already in place that are, you know, inherently racist as well, and how to, you know, and how to sort of, you know, adapt their policies. Because one of the things that's coming to mind for me, I recall at the school that I used to work at, the uniform policy meant that black boys, a lot of, you know, the black boys fell into a category where, because of their hairstyle, they did not, you know, adhere to the policy. Yes, the policy didn't, you know, outwardly name black boys, but you would look at assembly, the people that are being called out because of, you know, their hairstyle, because they didn't conform to the policy, were inherently black. So it's about schools considering, actually, if we've got policies in place that is impacting a certain community, what is it about, you know, those policies that is impacting those communities? And, you know, is there aspects of it that are racist, and thinking about representation as well within, you know, senior leadership teams. Because again, thinking back to that example that I just gave, like, there was no black representation in the senior leadership team at the school. And although I was a middle leader at the school, I'm confident that that is something that I would have, you know, challenged. But if you're, you know, white, you know, member of staff that's been at the school for a certain amount of years, you're just seeing it as just policy, and not the impact that it's having, you know, on certain, you know, on certain communities. So representation, especially in those areas of influence, you know, when it comes to policies.
100%. I mean, I think for me, it's just a very simple case of once you accept, and this is not like, I don't think there's any debate, but once you accept that the world that we live in, the West, this project that kicked off in 1492, if you want to get deep about it, this project called the West is steeped in white supremacist, colonial, European imperialist, patriarchal like ideologies, then you have to just accept that everything that's within that system is going to be subject to those same ideologies. And that means that our institutions, our systems, our schools are not safe spaces for certain groups. And that is not me trying to be controversial. I'm not here to argue that. That's just like what it is. And when you accept that, then it means that you have to have a level of reflection, and you have to have a level of vulnerability to look at your institution, to look at what you're part of, and to see these things, because the evidence is there. It's there, plain to see, you know, the over exclusion of black boys and girls, the tens of thousands of logged racist incidents when actually schools aren't legally required to log racist incidents, so it's probably far higher, the continual kind of like litany of microaggressions that black students and teachers are facing in our education system. These things aren't like, you don't have to go out of your way to find them. And so I feel like our school leaders, it's actually a vulnerability point. Are you able to sort of say, you know what, there's a problem here that I'm part of? I'm not saying it's your fault, but you're part of it. Mm. In the same way that I contribute to lots of things I didn't invent. You know, I'm not gay, so I do, in some way, I'm complicit in homophobia because my life is easier because I'm not gay. I'm not a woman, but I'm complicit in sexism and misogyny because my life is easier by the fact that I'm a man, and the world treats me very differently to how it treats my sisters and my aunties and my, you know, so on and so forth. And that requires vulnerability, because otherwise you accidentally uphold these problematic ideologies. And I think we see that happening in our schools, hence why we're still talking about it in the 21st century. It's mad when you think about it. Anyway, sorry.
I know it's...
High horse. I'll climb off my high horse now.
No, it's... Yeah, no, it's very telling.
Can I add one thing?
Yeah, of course.
I was going to say the idea of uniform is horrific. Because the clue is in the word. Why does it have to be uni? Mm. Like, why is everything uniform? And, like, when we're thinking about the embedded notions that are within that, it's like presentation is, it almost like is default with, like, the, you know, the cleanest, whitest aesthetic. Yep. But anything that is outside of that paradigm is going to be, like, it's going to be challenged, it's going to be penalised, and it's, like, time that we also realise that the school system is probably the best place that we start challenging these notions, because it's the same thing that happens in, like, the police force. It's the same thing that happens in, like, these same, like, words and terms that are used within the school are then replicated outside, and I think if we can tackle them very early on and actually, like contest these ideas, then it possibly could save a lot of other people who then go into the workplace and experience the same peer discrimination issues or, like, you know, microaggressions that happen. And I just think there's, like, anything that sits outside of the uniform or, like, what is seen as, like, default is going to be a problem.
Exactly.
And obviously we know that's blackness.
Yeah, of course.
100%. That's how you get through school, by being a facsimile of what the school system says is good. And for boys, because remember the Victorian system that he talked about, it was originally set up for the middle class sons. That's who school was for in this country. I hate to break it to everyone. It wasn't for working class people. It definitely wasn't for immigrants because we weren't around, and it definitely wasn't for non-white people. It was for middle class sons who were aspiring to a level of power that we still see in our political system. Because there's a reason that a bunch of boys that went to the same college end up running the country and know each other. It's not an accident. So the whole school system is like seeking to replicate a version of power that is definitely white, definitely male, definitely upper class, definitely massive air quotes, cultured, you know, in a very particular type of culture,
yeah.
Speak a certain way, read a certain number of books. And that means that anything which is not that is at deficit. So yeah. When you turn up and you're not that, you are already out the game unless you can pretend to be that. Yeah. Meanwhile, someone like Boris Johnson, you know, can become the prime minister. He's not even able, he's not even capable, and he's not particularly a moral person in lots of different ways. Don't quote me on that. Actually, quote me on that. You can quote me on that. So I think that speaks to this idea of this uniformity and what is it that we're trying to be like.
Yeah,
it's a very simple question.
No, thank you for sharing. And you know, there's been like a growing talk around, you know, embedding, you know, the black curriculum in schools. And you know, Lavinia, I know that you've done and continue to do amazing work in that field. And you know, I read a piece that you did with The Guardian last year, at the back end of last year, where you spoke about, you know, the black curriculum and embedding the black curriculum and making that mandatory within schools. And I wanted to ask, and I'll start with you, you know, Lavinia, what does that look like, you know, in school? So if, you know, if a head teacher said, okay, you know, we're taking this step, we want to, you know, embed the black, you know, curriculum, decolonize, you know, our curriculum, like, what does that look like practically within schools?
We don't use the word, not that I'm opposed to it, we just ain't use the word decolonize. I think we do need to use the word decolonize. We said embed because it was a more gentle way for, you know, sometimes you have to talk their language. And even so with embed, it was still very much a hard work. Like, when we say embed, we don't just mean add. We mean for it to be literally woven through everything that you do across the whole curriculum. So that's from your approach as a teacher to the content that you're using, to what you use on your boards, to how you allow Black languages or dialects to be used within the school system, to the training. So for me, it's like as Jeffrey said earlier, it's a 360 initiative. And I think often, because it just looks like the word curriculum, people just often take it as like, well, it means history. Mm-hmm. And then because we already have a history month, it just means putting Black people on the curriculum in Black History Month. And like, that's the opposite of what we're asking for. Mm-hmm. It's the opposite of what we're doing. Because this work, it can't be, like, it cannot be treated as an add-on. And I think, like, before I even get into any of that, if you as a teacher, if you as a school leader, or even as a parent, do not see young Black boys specifically as agents of their own, like, futures, if you don't value them, if you don't reward them, especially if they have SEND, then this work will never happen. Because for me, this work, it has to start there. It has to start at the point where Black boys who have been mistreated, misdiagnosed, excluded more than any other person, or counterpart within the country, if you're not recognizing them and empowering them, then the Black curriculum is kind of meaningless in your school. It can't just be as something that, you know, it's an initiative for a couple of students. It has to be something that you take seriously, and yeah, you're intimately caring about the students. Because I think sometimes people see this as like, it's just DEI work. No, it's not going to help you get your hit, and it's definitely not going to help you get a better Ofsted rating. And if it is, then you failed. If that's what your intention is, then like, you might as well just, like, not work with us. So I think, yeah, like, for me, it starts with the student. You have to see the student. And then it kind of takes it from there. So that's what I think embedding looks like. And obviously, we're in the year of the curriculum review. I think a lot of schools are now going to be embedding Black history. I think they need to be some kind of audit, personally,
yeah,
of what the schools are doing. And, yeah, also what the institutes that our teachers, the new teachers, are doing. Because I think that's also where it starts. Like, embedding Black history doesn't just start when you get into school. It starts in the training
mm-hmm.
that you receive. So, yeah. And see what happens.
That's a very good point. And when you mentioned as well that, you know, curriculum just isn't, or the Black curriculum just isn't about history, and it goes beyond history. And, you know, it reminds me that, you know, as a community, we've got so many amazing contributors to various fields within, you know, our community: music, literature, technology, the sciences, etc. So there's many, you know, people that we can lean on. And I think, you know, it's a question that we can come back to, but just have a thought of whose then responsibility is that to go and seek those resources, or, you know, those literatures and those work around, you know, Black experts or Black educators within specific fields that can be taught, you know, to the classes. Because essentially what teachers get now is, you know, this is your book, this is your curriculum based on what we've been doing over the last how many decades, Shakespeare, you know, Fitzgerald, and, you know, whatever else. But now it's like, if we're encouraging them to implement, you know, new literature and more you know, more resources or more curriculums that's focused on Black content, where do they get that from?
I mean for me, it's like, when we talk about Black history, we're talking about truth. Like, we're talking about a Black curriculum, we're talking about the truth curriculum, because that word Black doesn't limit itself to one particular ethnicity, ethnic group, nation, country, narrative, or story. It's actually a counter narrative to white supremacy. All right. That's what the Black, to me, a Black curriculum is, a counter narrative to a white supremacist curriculum, which has made itself supreme. Right. So once you accept that there is another truth, or there are hidden truths, because there's so many things. I made it all the way to the top of the tree. I've got a first class degree at university. People give me doctorates, for crying out loud. All right. And in that whole time, I learned nothing about my history as a Black person, as part of the diaspora. I learned nothing about African narratives, not just Ghanaian, my own ethnicity, but like the whole continent. I learned nothing about colonialism and white supremacy. And I made it to the top of the tree in this system. So the system is completely blind to some very, very important world truths. So I think that in terms of what you're seeking out, you're either seeking the truth or not. And your comfort becomes a big part of this. Can I wake up every day knowing that if I click, buy, I can get something sent to my house that was made by impoverished people 6 hours away on a plane who haven't got clean water? And can I live with that? I know it's uncomfortable because we live in the West and we live in a capitalist world and we all do that, right? But the truth is that I'm complicit. Now, if I'm racialized as white, the truth is that I'm living in a world that has rewarded my whiteness for no reason that I've made up, and that has done that at the expense of people who are not white, going back to ideas that were seeded in the 1600s. All right. Now, if you want the truth, it's liberating, but it's going to shake you up a little bit. Now, I think that, just personally, seeking the truth actually energizes me. I want to know more about, why am I acting this way as a man? Why am I acting this way as a British person? Why do I like what I like? What does this thing mean? And it actually empowers me. It empowers me. If you're scared of being empowered, you're gonna run away from the Black curriculum.
Yeah.
Because you don't want the truth. Yeah.
I love that. Because I think it just starts with, like, curiosity.
Yeah.
And ultimately what we're talking about is, like, being a student of life, and, like, I like completely just don't understand the British system. Because when I'm in America, right, they love this continued professional development. Because mm-hmm. it's like, I just want to learn. I just want to pick things up. And it's like, when we're in the UK school system, it's like, another thing?
Yeah.
And it's like, I get that, but it's almost like the structures and the rewarding of the different structures is very different. So it's like, in America, you're rewarded to become better in your, you know, in your job, in your profession. Mm. And as a teacher and as a leader of students, but in the UK there's no reward, like especially when it comes to like anti-racism, I think the framing of it is very much like, if you don't do it, you're going to jail. And like that doesn't make people feel like, I want to do this, I want to yeah. learn. It's almost like an added burden.
Yeah.
So I would love, I don't know how it's going to happen, but I would love for the UK system to get to a place where it's like, people are just hungry for knowledge, and like, it's just, they're rewarded for being hungry.
Yeah. Yeah, and it liberates you. This is the thing which I just don't get why you wouldn't want that, because you are empowered and liberated by having more context. This is why marginalized narratives are important, because they give you more perspective. Mm-hmm. I don't know enough about the world from the intersections of my identity as a black, millennial, British-born, son of Ghanaian immigrant, male, whatever. That's not enough perspective. What do I know about being trans? Like, real talk. And actually, would it help me to be a better person in the world if I knew those narratives? Yes, it would, because I've got nieces and nephews who are LGBT, and their perspective is different to me and my sisters and so on. So we need to listen to those people. Now, that's just one example. So if you don't embrace marginalized narratives, you're at the mercy of the dominant narrative. And that's exactly what we see in all of our systems. It's got them by the throat and they think they're comfortable, but really they're just like, they can't move. You know, it's not the same as comfort.
Yeah.
You want to be free of that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, definitely. And, Lavinia, I loved how you used that term of, you know, embedding and not, you know, decolonizing the curriculum, because you want it, you know, woven, you know, into the school systems. I know one thing that I had, you know, difficulty with at my previous school was doing stuff around Black history outside of Black History Month. And it was a bit like, oh, you want to do something outside of your month? You don't want to wait till October, or it's after October and it's like, oh, you guys want to keep, you know, going? And there's a lot of investment, you know, into that period, or sometimes there's minimal investment or the expectation of, you know, oh, the Black staff aren't doing anything for that. And I guess my question is, like, how can we embed, you know, those curriculums, those cultures, so that they are woven within the school system, like throughout the year, throughout the academic year, and just not fixed, you know, in 1 month?
I would think that beginning with like the planning of the budget, I don't know when it started, it's like April, right? Is that when the school budgets are usually planned, April? Mm,
yeah, April, yeah.
Okay. So I'd say beginning there, because again, this work needs investment for it to happen. Beginning there needs to be some conversation around like activities for the whole year. And I see it sometimes as like, you know, staff will start off in September with an inset day, and then maybe there's another kind of like activity for Black History Month, and then another one for like June, which is like Windrush, or an end of school kind of activity. But I think if teachers are already doing it in Black History Month, then there's a case for it to be made. It's not a whole year, at least a season. Camden Council are doing Black History Seasons, which is better than a lot of other councils, by extending it from like October to, I think, December. And I think if you're a teacher and you're already kind of doing it, and you need the support, I think leaning on organisations that are committed about the Black curriculum, BLAM UK, I'm trying to think of some others right now, my mind's gone blank. But there's so many that are committed to kind of training and working with students all year round. Also researchers, there's a lot of individual students who are doing great PhDs who are able to come in and support with like knowledge. And I think that would be like a good place for teachers who are already kind of doing this work, in fact, just want to continue it and to make a case for it. But I would say, like, April is the time, like, whatever this budget's been created, that is the time to set the agenda, because unless that happens, then it's almost like, well, we ain't got the budget for it. That's, like, 90% of the time why people can't do the service because they can't afford it or there's no investment in it. So it has to start there. And I think if it can't start there, then it needs to be something that maybe the SLT, like, or, like, it's not... it's not an ask, it's actually a requirement.
That's powerful, April.
let's get the investments, let's be in intentional with it. I think that's important.
And just on the back of that, because I feel like the reason why this doesn't happen and when people don't start factoring in these conversations in their financial planning and their strategizing for the year is because they just don't see it as essential. They don't see what's at stake by not doing this work. They don't really acknowledge or respect the fact that this work can offer solutions to problems that they need meeting. If the government turned around and said, your school will not pass its next Ofsted or whatever, unless it actually can prove it's doing anti-racist work, every school in the country, because head teachers know how to make things happen, every school in the country would become an excellent anti-racist school within a half a term. So the issue here is that doing anti-racist work doesn't solve any emergent problems in the eyes of the mainstream. I think there needs to be a real flip on that, because I've seen personally visiting schools, I visit schools up and down the country, how even a little bit of the work that you're doing, Lavinia, Blam, like you said, everyday racism, some of my work, even a little bit can solve massive problems within school communities in terms of social cohesion amongst different ethnic groups and communities, in terms of why a generation is kind of using or kind of abusing Black culture in a social media space. What is going on with the N-word being used by everyone on TikTok? Like, these are problems that schools come to me quietly and they say, we've got an issue with this. And they don't understand that actually the work that we're talking about is a direct route to solving these problems. If you put it like that, people do want their problems solved. If you deny the problem, then you're never going to do the work.
Yeah, that's very telling. And, you know, I know you both do, you know, amazing work sort of up and down the country, globally, you know, advocating for anti-racist practice, you know, diverse Black curriculums. What's the most challenging things that you guys have experienced in terms of, you know, advocating for our community, especially around, you know, education? Like, what's the most challenging things that you guys have sort of come across?
I'm going to say two things. The first thing is the fear of Blackness. I think sometimes there's like this utmost sensitivity when it comes to just saying the word Black, and by definition what we mean by Black, sometimes there's like a pushback to that, meaning campus not just be for like everyone or like a BAME situation, and it's not that. It's really not that. So I would say that we face like a ideological pushback to like the implementation of a true African-centered curriculum, because that's really what we're talking about here, right? Mm-hmm. African knowledges, cosmologies, experiences. I think that's really the kind of like worry for a lot of people, like literally the fear of a Black nation or Black presence. And then I would also say that we've literally had schools say, like, is this content going to be too radical? What does that mean? So I think ultimately the pushback for us, and I don't think it's just limited to schools, I think it's the environment that we're operating in, where there has been a fear culture that's been engineered by current and previous governments, whereby there's a limit, there's a cap on how far people are willing to go. And it's like they've already made up in their minds that this is as far as they want the information to go. I think any deeper is too much. It's going to scare people. It's going to put off people. So, like, even to say, I remember I was in, this is kind of off topic, but right on point. I was in a conversation with someone from the DfE, and I was the only Black person there. And the guy who was doing the conversation was like, we're not using the word decolonize. I was like, well, if you can't use the word decolonize, this work has no hope. And he was literally talking about like reframing the curriculum and things like that. So I just think there's like a cap on like truth telling, as you say, Jeff. So yeah, I think that's the biggest thing. Because it's like, unless we have the opening, then it can go, it can work, but it's not going to go as deep as we needed to do shifting. So
yeah, no, that's, yeah. You know, a few things are sort of coming to mind, that idea of truth telling and this fear of blackness. You know, it's that, you know, many want to be comfortable. Even you give an example of the gentleman saying, actually, we're not going to use this term. Yeah, because you want to use the term that you're comfortable with. You want to, you know, embed or implement anti-racist practice to the point where, you know, once you reach the ceiling, this is it now. Let's get it in, you know, let's get it in, you know, sort of small drips. Like, let's not be too radical, you know, as you mentioned. But then, you know, we need to be encouraged to be curious, to want to learn more about, you know, the amazing people within our communities, within the other communities that, you know, we might not be aware of, and just to understand how much, you know, we have to offer. And, you know, I was thinking this the other day when I was watching I'm not sure if you guys have seen the Tyler Perry movie, 6888. And I was watching that movie, and I'm not gonna share it, but I'm sure people have watched it. And it's about, I think, like the first black female or black women's like army cohort in America, and they did some amazing work around, you know, getting like the post sent out to, you know, soldiers and their families during the war. And this is a story that, you know, I'd never heard of. But you hear about everything else regarding, you know, the war in America and the soldiers and, you know, Britain and whatever else. And it just made me realise, and it goes back to the word that you was using, Jeff, that curiosity. It made me think, how many amazing untold stories of black people or black communities that would be so relevant and so powerful to our community that we are, you know, unaware of. So yeah, and with that fear of blackness and with that uncomfortability, I think the question I want to pose now is like, how, if there are teachers, and I know there are some teachers who may, you know, want to, you know, implement and advocate and adopt, you know, some of the strategies that we've mentioned, but they either feel, you know, uncomfortable or unprepared, you know, how can we support these senior leaders or these head teachers to take, you know, that step?
Narine's already said it, you know, what was it? Where the heart is, the action follows, whatever, like that, yeah, that's not a small statement. That's very, very true. If there is intent, then things will happen. Changes will take place. Even if it's just, because one of the problems with education is that it's got this myth of control, because of the system itself is very controlling and kind of paranoid over its kind of proving itself according to whichever currencies it deems to be valuable. Be it qualifications, or I don't know what else is valuable in education. But so the controlling thing means that school leaders and therefore teachers need to be in control. That's why we have silent classrooms and rows and weird policies that are very, very Victorian still, because it looks like control and it means that nothing can go wrong, right? But actually, in reality, what school leaders need to do is
relinquish some of that anxiety over controlling everything and just seek to see what's going on with fresh eyes and accept what the situation is. And then it starts to design itself, actually. It becomes very apparent what to do when you acknowledge the problems around you. But when you're blinkered to those problems, you won't even know what the next step is. It's like the metaphor people use of if there's a small fire in the corner of the room, but you ignore the fire, it's just going to grow. When you accept that there's a fire burning, you obviously act. And I feel like that's something which has been built into the education system, this kind of insecurity. I feel like one of the things which would be which would be incredibly useful, maybe it's just on my wish list, is if educators were just released from that and were just encouraged to lead with their core values. And that sounds easy, but it's not, because the system only really permits and rewards what it wants to permit and reward. That's why we've got Black History Month. That's why you get politicians parroting those few words from Martin Luther King as though that's all he said. Martin Luther King was a leftist radical, and he got increasingly radical, to use that term, up to the point where he was basically murdered. But it's an easy thing to say, well, that Black civil rights leader said, I want Black and white children to hold hands. And they, so it accepts a level of Blackness that it's comfortable with. It creates a narrative that that does not upset the status quo. And school leaders are going to do the same thing, unfortunately, until they accept that actually there are things here that need to be disrupted.
Yeah.
And that's not a negative thing. That's not like, I'm not saying burn everything down and be an anarchist. I'm just saying that if something is problematic, it needs disruption in order to be fixed. And that's a very human thing when we're talking about people's lives and communities, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know what I've just said there. I've said a few things.
No, definitely. I agree. And I wanted to touch base with you, Lavinia, because one of the things that, you know, I'm conscious of and I really appreciate is that, you know, within the work that you do, that you have, you know, some amazing young people, you know, who work with the Black curriculum to, you know, amplify the work that you do. And I know we've spoken a lot about the influence of, you know, policy leaders and those who are unseen, etc. And I wanted to sort of know your point of view, first of all, is, you know, how important are, you know, the voices of, you know, young people, of parents and the community in pushing the work that we are trying to push right now around anti-racist practice and embedding, you know, the Black curriculum in schools. Like, how important are those voices in doing that?
I think it's vital in an environment where children are despised. Ultimately, I think there's more than a war on young people, from like their education to their voices to the lack of investment. And for us at the Black curriculum, we've always been student driven. I was 22 when I set it up. I invited my friends who were in uni to join me. They've now moved on. And for me, the legacy of the Black curriculum is the young people. It has to be, because like it's ultimately who we want things to happen for and with. And it's that empowerment. So I would say that, like, without their voices, there's no relevancy of this material. It's like we're working with teachers to give them trainings, and like, it's not just for the fun of it. It's literally for like, the end user. I hate to use that term, but it's literally for the students, so that they can have that information. They can come out empowered. They know who they are ultimately, and can take that knowledge to shift society. Because I remember, like, speaking with some of the young people who are still working with us as young champions, they are also still experiencing the same thing, like in uni, and sometimes being the only person on their course who is like, she's amazing. One of our interns is called Eden, and she is studying philosophy at Warwick, and she's one of three Black people on the entire course. And it's like, why is that still a thing? Why is, like, and also the teachers as well, why are the lecturers still able to kind of, like, present Eurocentric philosophy as the only medium of like knowledge, right? That's verifiable. So I think they're still facing the same systemic issues that we have. And it's like, unless we are really tapped in to the present issues that are like happening in society, like we can't solve it because we're detached. Like, I'm not in school anymore, I'm not in uni. So it has to start there, is where I see it. And also parents as well, who oversee their children's learning, and also I think are also responsible for what the children are learning at home. Because one thing I want to make clear is that this is not just a movement of education for the schools, it's for the parents too. It's important that they're involved as much as the teachers are in this education, and we need their voices. We need to know what kind of things that they are disappointed in, what things they want to learn, so that we can actually kind of advocate for that change to happen. Because without it, it's like, it's just an exercise of like arrogance from ourselves as educators or as people who've gone through university. So yeah, it's so vital.
Yeah, we need to join the dots on a lot of different things. Like, as a parent myself, there's a reason why me and my boys sit down and we talk about colonialism, and there are certain books that I put in front of them, and I'm that awful parent. I like to sit them down and do lessons with them, but I feel like it's important knowledge they're not going to get from school. But that's just not me bigging myself up. There's also like publishing as a sector. Which books are making it into the hands of parents and why? Which authors are being supported? It's hard to make a living writing books. So there's a lot of, there are some thought leaders out there who are producing incredible works of fiction and nonfiction that are essential for all students, not just your black students, not all students. You've got to teach kids the whole alphabet. These white kids need to know about white supremacy, right? But the books don't make it into Asda and the supermarket and into the libraries and into the school bookshelf. So therefore, that knowledge is just, it's in the blind spot. They don't even know that they don't know it. Joining the dots is important. You know, who's championing the right books? How does that person link to education? What's the education minister doing in terms of those conversations? What's happening with parents and social services? I know it sounds complex, but it's really just getting people to sit down and look up and go, yeah, this isn't great. All right, cool. What can we do? Well, let's start talking to each other.
Yeah. No, that's amazing. Thank you. And just to finish off with, so looking ahead into the future, sort of 5, 10, 15 years, etc., what are your hopes for the landscape of education if, you know, anti-racist, you know, practice and, you know, the black curriculum is implemented, you know, successfully in schools? Like, what excites you most about the potential of, you know, that sort of coming into fruition, and yeah, so what are your hopes for education in that sense for the future?
I would say my mind instantly goes to like what young people do after education. Like, cause for me, knowledge is not just knowledge, it's knowledge to do something with it. And I would hope that young people are able to really like where I say contest the system, like decide whether this UK is something that they want to engage with, and how they engage with it, they have the means and the power to set things up for themselves, like develop things for their community that's going to improve like the livelihood and the outcomes of other young people. I'd also say that I want to see new centres of learning. I don't like the structures of learning that currently exist. I think there needs to be like different types of education centres that are like accredited or awarded in the same way as that universities are. And it's just unfortunate that like universities, as a global model of learning, it prioritizes certain like ways to kind of succeed, and there's no support for students who are more technical, more practical. So I think like there needs to be different types of education centres, and I think that's my hope. I know that's my hope. I want to see that, and yeah, and have people succeed in all ways, like not just like because you're good at reciting or memorizing. So, yeah.
How about for you, Jeff?
I just really hope that that we get past, and when I say we, I mean like the Western society in general, gets past this blind spot and this
inability to address the situation for what it is, to every person to have a working knowledge of what racism is and what it's rooted in would be transformative. You know, like, I'm old enough to remember when people just go to the shop and just like pick up 28 plastic bags and just use two of them and throw the rest away, and then go home and spray an aerosol can into the ozone layer, and then just like open your cereal packet and then single-use plastic toys. And we, like, now we're all slightly horrified by these things because it's been a general level of education about the planet and the climate change. And I know there's still people that don't care, but it's a lot easier to recycle and so on. And this wasn't like no one got sat down and had a lecture. We just, as a society, we just got a bit better in the West at that. If we could do that with white supremacy, with anti-racism, with all these conversations, then your next generation would be intentional about how they are in the world, about the institutions they step into, about what they're going to back and why. And that would be actually transformative, because these young people, you know, they need to be clued up in order to be intentional about all the things that we've talked about that we know need to happen. So that's what I'd love to see. Yeah,
that's amazing. And I think for me, it's one of, you know, the things that will stand out for me, especially within the education theories, is, you know, to have students sort of champion the work that we are pushing for, to have students, you know, being, you know, those advocates. And I think that, you know, the work that each of us are doing within, you know, our fields is legacy work, you know. But we also have to acknowledge that we're not always going to be around. So what can we, you know, leave behind for the future generations, you know, whether it's our children, whether it's our students or the young people that interact with us, you know, by any means, whether they've listened to, you know, this podcast or a TikTok clip or whatever that may be, to continue and really, you know, push, you know, the work that, you know, we are doing and are so intentional, you know, advocating for. Because, you know, I can sit here and look back at my time at school and say that at no point did I question or challenge anything that I was studying, because I was conformed. I thought, actually, this is what everyone studies and this is, you know, how school is meant to be. But then, you know, you grow, you become more curious, as you've mentioned, Jeff, and that curiosity has allowed me to realize that actually there are so many students who are in that bubble, who are in that sort of structured, you know, of conformity, like within schools, and really just trying to, you know, empower those communities, empower the students to really be advocates, to really find their voices, you know, and push for that. So that would be my thoughts. So as we end on that note, I wanted to thank you both again for joining me on this episode. You know, it's been amazing. It's been insightful. And I look forward to, you know, working and collaborating with you both again in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, guys. And that has been the Too Cool for School podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and follow us on our social media pages. Thank you.